Lads, I have Tom Haddington with me though. We'll be speaking to Tom very, very shortly indeed about a few things out in... Oh, just a manifest. Tom, pull up a microphone, Tom, there. Because, look, I printed out some of that, Tom. That's probably what you're going to show me, Tommy, is it?
Number one there, Mick. Number one there.
Good morning, Mick.
Good morning,
good
Tom.
Good morning, listeners. And first of all, before I go any further, all the best to Tommy. I heard he's gone. We're going losing a very good man again next week. But sure, look,
we sure are.
We're losing him all the time. As I can say, we can get rid of Phil Dixon, though. We'll be laughing.
We're losing him, Tommy. We're losing him to a killer woman, and we've got a killer man in instead.
Well, so we
balance the books here.
My mother was a killer woman, actually. So they're good. They're a good crowd out there.
Oh, yeah.
No, Mick. Look, as you know, I am. Thanks for letting me come in. I send you. On the eve of D-Day, last Wednesday night,
the fifth of June, yeah,
it was that night. I sent you a picture of a copy or a picture I took of the logbook,
yeah,
that was written on the actual eve of D-Day out in Knockadoon lookout post. And as you know, Mick, I mean, the reason for all these lookout posts was basically because of the Second World War. And, of course, this was the 5th of June, 1944. And as we all know, there was a lot of stuff ready to take off or blast off, I suppose, across the English Channel on the same evening and the same night. And
all top secret.
All top secret, wasn't it?
And like, nobody knew.
The reason I printed it out and showed it to you was it's actually a very kind of standard enough evening for the boys. Like, there was, you know, there was nothing kind of... You know,
there was no warning that was happening.
And as you can see, if you go down along the... No, it's hard to read it, but I'm kind of getting a bit more used. But the dates are very good. Like,
they are unbelievable. And
the times, like, you have it there, no mix.
Yeah, it was around 4:10 in the afternoon.
If you see the first one there, we'll say go back to that night. No, we'll say there was something logged. The two lads taking over. And then about 20 to 1, they just logged that they had rang the rang you all
at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
at 1 o'clock under sick, they said heard noise of aircraft
heading south of the post.
You know,
So everything that happened, they basically logged it, right?
Yeah.
But now the aircraft could have been who knows what it was really. But there's another one there. Then later on, they rang Mella. Now the ringing the Mella was.
Yes, that's just there, yeah. That was at 2:40.
Yeah, Mallow and Yall were the two stations. I say it's a station in Yall, probably was the Garda station, probably.
Yeah, they call that.
But the one in Mallow would have been the Army one.
Okay.
So I think twice a shift or once a shift, and the shifts were 8 hours, they had to ring.
Both.
They had to ring either both or ring one.
Right, okay, Tom.
So they just rang Mallow just to let them know that they were alive and that they were there.
For test.
And but like, as you can see, Mick, there's not a whole pile written on that one. Like,
no, because they said they rang at 3 o'clock in the Argyle station. All okay. You know,
at 3 o'clock, like, I mean, after midnight, things were starting to take off over on the south coast of England when the paratroopers were starting to take off and head for Normandy.
Right,
because the paratroopers were the first guys to land in Normandy.
Right,
at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and they all went over in these gliders.
Okay.
And the gliders, like, a lot of them were killed, actually, when they hit the ground. Because the Germans had the fields, it feels inward from the cliffs now, is inland. They had all these we call them trunks of trees. And from each trunk, there was a strand of wire.
Oh.
So any glider came in,
just
ripped apart. But that was the most famous one that landed in inside the lines. There was the one at Pegasus Bridge, which is the very famous one in Normandy. I don't know if you were ever there, Mick.
No,
I was lucky enough to be there. Like, and it actually landed at a bridge, which this bridge was a fierce strategic point.
Right.
Over the river that was going to Caen, and it had to be taken fairly early in the operation, and. It was taken eventually. Like, no, they had a last life there, but they did get through it, and they held that bridge, which gave them a kind of a foothold in for the Allies during the morning to get inland. But you know, it's just the logbook itself, as you can see, Mick, I have the original here in front of me.
That's incredible, Tom.
Which is
that's
lovely.
A feeling.
No, having said that, I must thank the person that has lended this to me.
Yes.
And I've only have it on loan.
Yeah.
Because
a valuable, valuable.
My idea is to go through the pages, start. It's a 1944, so start probably in January. Try and make out as much as I can what's written.
Yeah.
There's obviously stuff in there that's very interesting.
Oh, I'd say that, Tom.
But I just went to that page.
Yeah, because that
of
page.
The eve of the, of, and like, that's of the actual, yeah. Like, the writing is done by the volunteers, Mick, if you could, as you can see there.
Yeah, handing over to Connolly and Cronin.
Yeah. That Connolly, was no, Connolly, first. Connolly was Davy Connolly, right?
Right.
And his niece is just living down the road from me. She's in her early 90s now.
My goodness.
Or her late 90s, probably. No, she'd be in her maybe her late 80s. And a grand, probably, niece of hers is next door to me. Of his, sorry.
Okay, yeah.
And the Cronin is Johnny Cronin, and the Cronins are very. You probably know his son, Billy Cronin.
He was
a welder.
Yeah, yeah. Do well.
That's his son.
And he
had a brother serving there as well, called either Paddy Cronin or Patty Cronin.
Okay.
But the two boys were the boys that were taking over that night, like.
Yeah, know? Because it says here then taking over the watch top.
Taking over the watch.
Yeah.
Taking over watch.
John Slocum, I'd say.
John Slocum.
And Ned Cotterner.
Michael Cotter.
Michael Cotter, is
and
it?
Do you know who he was, Mick? Michael Cotter.
No.
Do you know Finn's Bear outside in Ballymacore?
Yes.
John. He was the man that owned that bear before
Finn's. Ah, go
Michael
yeah.
Cotter. Yeah.
My goodness.
He had two sisters there called Sheila and, oh, I can't think of her second name, or the other sister. But he took over that bear. That's the same man. But, it's just, I just thought on the night I'd send you that, and I actually sent it to Patrick as well.
Right, yeah.
Because there's one piece you're very sighted, two destroyers off the cliff or something, relatively unknown. I can see they're on the six, at 1653.
Yeah, this is incredible.
Yeah, Patrick, you're alongside me there. No, I'm just for the listeners there. I'm just opening the page there. Now that we're moving on. We've moved from the 5th now up to D-Day itself, which is the 6th.
But just like Tommy, like the book is so clean. You know, it's not like the outside of it is just it's rusty, but like the inside of it, it's like as if. It's a children's book from 10 years ago.
That's right. I mean, like look how nice the writing is of Patrick in it. Like, I mean, the joint writing is absolutely beautiful. Like, so like they took fierce pride in what they were doing in what they were doing. Like, you know, it was the writing is so clear and like.
Oh yeah, that's the line I was reading. Sighting, like, yeah. Sighted two destroyers. Look, off the cliff, unknown.
Unknown, yeah,
nationality,
yeah.
Unknown.
Yeah.
Report
to
this.
And if you can see already, they had the weather. They always reported
visibility
the
very
way
good.
The weather
yeah.
Was.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
But like, this is the actual book. Like I said, I'm very privileged to have got a loan to this. And like, I can't emphasize enough. This is only I've only a loan to this. But
there's some amount of entries in that book. Tom.
Well, Pat or Michael, my idea is to go through every page of it. And try and pick out the things that kind of stick
exactly,
out with because
exactly.
There is stuff that sticks out, like, you know.
But to have that deal, as you say,
it's unbelievable.
On the eve, Tom. Yeah. On the
on
eve.
On the eve of D-Day. Like.
Of D-Day is incredible to have that.
Yeah. And like the dates are so clear. Like if you they could have written them yesterday.
And the thing about it, they didn't fill that in knowing what was coming.
No.
They just filled that in.
No.
As they'd fill in if there was a fishing boat or something.
No.
In
no.
Distress.
No. And like. Like, I'm interested to go on to the 7th of June, like, and we say the 8th of June.
Yeah.
Just before you do that, like, there's a 4-hour gap, or a 6-hour gap there.
Obviously yeah. Nothing happening.
Nothing happening in the meantime.
At 8 o'clock in the morning, on the 6th of D-Day itself, I was written here, was taking over watch, was Michael Cotter and John Slocum.
Yeah.
And John Slocum was the corporal. There was two corporals, John Slocum and Davy Connolly, right? And then they put in their next log in at 10 o'clock. LOP was a correct, very simple one here. LOP clock, correct time with exchange.
Oh, yes,
so
yes,
they
yeah.
actually checked the clock to see was it telling him the right time.
Oh, right.
At 10 o'clock in the morning, all hell was breaking loose at 10 o'clock in the morning over in France, like.
And nobody knowing.
I mean, they were well invading the beaches at that stage, like.
Unbelievable.
Hundreds of thousands had been killed at that, or a hundred, like a lot of bodies had been killed at that stage.
Thousands
been killed at that stage, like.
Actually, when I was looking at this the other night, my wife Anne looked in at something for me, and the figure was frightening. Yeah.
I got a figure the other night, Mick, and watching a documentary. There was 6,500 between Germans, probably French and British, Canadian, 6,500 a day. During the Normandy assault, which was done for
a
few months. Like.
It was frightening, because I defeat the total figures there, you know. But Tom, that manuscript that you have there now, is that in a very secure place?
Oh, it is, yeah.
That is
it
something,
is,
Tom, that,
is,
my
is,
God.
The person
original,
that gave it to me, I actually got permission from yesterday evening to know could I bring it in? Could I speak about it and all that? And he had no problem, but like that again, he did say, look after it. Because it is, I suppose it should be probably put away in a museum, but the thing like we feel about that outside is that if we give that up to Dublin, right, the chances are it'll be very hard for people locally to see it. Like, so what we'd like to do is to keep it local so that the like all the offsprings of these men, a lot of them are still, families are still in the area.
I know what you mean.
And like, you know, if this goes to Dublin, you'll have to go online to get it. And a lot of the old people don't like doing that kind of stuff. Like,
no,
you know what I mean?
No.
If for the likes of me now, and who I got a loan of it off of, I mean, I will look after this and it'll be kept in a secure place. But like, it is a nice thing for the next generation
of
to
course
see, like,
it is, Tom.
You know?
Of course. You know? And just looking at the total figures here, Tom, from Didier, it's a German casualties on D-Day have been estimated between 4,000 and 9,000, just on D-Day. Allied casualties were at least 10,000, with 4,414 confirmed dead. So you could put the figure anywhere between 10,000 and 20,000.
Like,
Tom, before I interrupt you, you're going to move on to the next page, the 7th of June.
I haven't even looked at this, no, Patrick, to be honest with you, but you know, you can see the 7th of June there at midnight, taking over watch was the same two chaps that with Johnny Cronin and Marcy Smith.
Sorry to interrupt you, Sam. Have we any idea when they realised what was happening?
Outside in...
Yeah, in that...
Locally, like?
No, yeah.
Like I said, no, Mick, I haven't...
When you go through that, I'd love for you to come back
more,
to me again.
Yeah, because we're down here now to 12:30 the following day.
Right.
And actually, the writing is actually way more clear here, Mick, if you look at it.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it is... But, like, there's probably a programme on this page.
There
like,
is,
you know
yeah.
I mean? And I've said that to you before.
That's
like,
right, that's you know, right,
we,
that's right.
I think we should try and go out and actually be out, situated
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
If we only gave it a half an hour.
Yeah, I agree.
And I can take stuff out of this that would be, say, oh, you know, what happened over there? Or, you know, I mean, something small. But before I go away from the main logbook, Mick, just to give you a couple of figures there before I go, your time is tight. The number of bodies, Mick, right?
Right.
That were washed ashore. Now, I presume this is Ireland in general, right? In 1940, no. This is the start of the war, obviously. I'm kind of going away from D-Day now.
Okay.
But in this is 1940, now. The number of bodies are washed ashore. In July, there was 13 bodies in 1940. This is the first year of the war, now.
Okay.
In August, that jumped up to 76. In September, it was 64. This is all 1940. In October, it was 19. And then for some strange reason, there was a massive drop down to 8 in November. And then it shot back up again in December 33. But if you add all them up from July down to December, I haven't even added them up now,
right,
but there's 13,
right.
76, 64, 19, 8 and 33.
There's 200 people there, is that?
150.
Washed ashore.
Yeah. In,
obviously around the coast of Ireland now. Probably more so the east and the south coast of Ireland.
That's against the...
This is the very first year of the war, 1940. You know, like if a body's washed ashore now, tis on national news and but like that time they were being washed ashore, like plastic had been washed ashore, like, you know what I mean? It's absolutely crazy. And just on the mines, Mick, right? Between 1940 and 1941, there was 100 mines came ashore between Ring in Waterford and Ballycotton.
How many?
100 mines came ashore. Because the Allies had laid a minefield in the Celtic Sea So that's probably a reason for that too, like they broke away from their anchorage. And the first mine that was recorded at Remhid on this on one of these log books was the 24th of January 1941. And the 27th of January 1941, there was five mines between Whiting Bay and Ballyquin.
Between Whiting Bay and Ballyquin?
Yeah, five mines came ashore. Yeah, so like it just goes to show
how many were over the ticket the action.
I told you this before, the last time I spoke with us, that my mother, Latimer Sinner, she was a young girl. She actually came from Ballykilty in Killa, and she didn't end living in Glenavulling where we live.
Right.
She used to come down as she was between 11 and 14 years of age during the war years, we'd say, right? But she often told me that a mine would strike the rocks, literally, the house that she was living in at the time, as she used to visit her aunt. Just below that, they were literally living on the cliff. But a mine would strike the rocks, and all the wear on the presses would actually fall off down the ground and shatter.
A mine
actually would explode, would actually shatter. So like, and she also taught me that as a child again, they can remember at night time. The sky lighting up out to the southeast.
Right.
And I often thought about this now since, right? I reckon that was Bristol. Because Bristol got an awful hammering during the war.
Okay.
And Bristol probably would be the closest.
And the
to
glare.
Us.
The glare.
And at night time, you know, certain nights now, the sky, the horizon would be flashing kind of thing. Now, it could be out in the sea as well, but I reckon it was that. Because they actually could hear noises as well. Okay. And she told me that, you know.
Noel, that's interesting manuscript there. That manuscript that Tommy has brought in there is something else.
Pardon me now, because I was actually inside in the other studio recording John Young, so I'm new to this, but I understand this is the logbook actually from the
1944
Knockadoon Post
in 1944.
If you go back a page there, we're on D-Day. The seventh, right?
The 6th of June, yeah.
But this is the one is the 6th of June here somewhere.
6th, yeah.
No, go back.
On the 4th.
You'll find it there, Patrick.
Yeah. On the 4th of June.
Yeah.
And
there, 6th of June.
Yeah.
So this is actually the Eva D-Day. Noel, we're looking at there.
That's and Tom, can I ask you, is there
real?
And of course, on D-Day. Was there anything unusual?
Michael has it there, and we just went through.
Was there anything unusual?
No, it was just a standard night.
A standard night.
Well, it was a standard evening. They took on the watch at midnight on D-Day.
Yes.
And it was just a standard watch. They spotted there was a plane that they heard the noise of. There was they had the ring mellow once a shift.
Yes.
And just to confirm that they were there and that they were in contact, because they had the phones in the lookout post at that stage. And then they rang Yall, which would probably be Yall Garda Station.
Yes.
And just to confirm everything was okay.
And of course,
and
it must be
all hell was breaking loose at this stage over in France.
Over in France, you know, from Dover to France. But of course, it must be said at this stage, the phones, they were all, there was no dialing system, it was operators.
Operators,
it was
yeah.
All operators.
That's right.
You could
that's
you,
right.
Know?
No, yeah, but, yeah.
Of course, that's the little lookout post now out right over.
Yeah, number 21.
Number 21.
As you know, Noel, there was 82, 83 of them built around the coast of Ireland.
There was another one in Ardmore.
Ardmore
was number 20.
Powerhead. There was one in Powerhead in just beyond Ballycotton. Mm. That was 22. And so along the coast, in the numbers rose. As you went back east, the numbers went down.
Yeah.
But, I have a kind of a passion about this because I took a savage interest in this about the last 4 or 5 years. And my biggest regret is that I didn't ask my mother and father more about them when I was younger.
That's the
because
mistake.
Because they were teenagers. They were in their 13s, 12, 13, 14 years of age, especially my father, that I didn't ask him enough about it.
Yeah. But that's the mistake. I've
kind of covered that now since, because I've spoken to two people that, thank God, they're still alive. Mm. They're in their 90s now. Paddy Hyde out in Ballyfroid, you know Paddy.
I do know Paddy, yeah.
I had a good interview with Paddy in only 25 minutes. I've recorded and all.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a woman called Nellie Sloan.
Yes.
She was Nellie Holding. Glenavulling again.
Yes.
And she I had a good chat with her. But like you said before, and I've heard you yourself in the past, they don't seem to want to talk about it that much. It's hard to draw it out of them.
It's
like,
very hard to draw, because you see, what you must, I suppose, if you put yourself in their situation at their time, and as I said, the technology that they had in their time, it was a very, very frightening experience.
It was. And that's
a very, very frightening experience for them, you know.
And that's the point I'm trying to make about this all the time. Like we can all stand back here and say, Asher did a handy job for 4 years in the lookout post, looking out to sea, and it was all great and blah, blah, blah. But at the time, they didn't know no more than the man on the moon who was going to invade them. Like, Hitler True. Could have invaded Cock Harbour. Like.
Oh, but he was poised to. So wasn't he poised?
He was actually poised. And the thing about Cock Harbour was
a deep water berth.
It was, and it was a fierce, important harbour to invade. Like.
I think, there's a well-known, a famous radio broadcast, I think, by the BBC, in which Churchill publicly asked De Valera over the BBC network for the use of the deep water ports, and apparently they've thought about this for a while, so he gave his answer over the RTE airwaves,
yeah,
which he rebuffed him and said, you're not getting it, end of story, like, you know, for 700 years we've been under your thumb, yeah, why should we give it to you now, kind of thing, you know. But there is there was a famous broadcast made then. But getting back to the watchtowers, as you say, like, they were dotted all over the coast.
They were?
All over the coast. And each one had a phone line back to, we'll say, back to the exchange or whatever the case may
and
be.
And in fact, in Diva 44, D-Day 44, it was Mella.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in the earlier years it was Cork, but then they went to Mella.
Mella was
the army side of it.
Yeah.
And then obviously Yall was the exchange side of it.
There was one famous one told, I think, was it in, I don't know, is it in Yall now or Ardmore, but the lad that was in watch in Ardmore was a fabulous accordion player, apparently. And he rang up the fella in Yall and he said, do you want to hear me playing the accordion? So he played the accordion over the phone to him.
Well, we
talk about technology, like.
We had a man in Knockadoon.
Yeah.
Teddy Shea.
Teddy Shea, tall man. Yeah.
And the funny story about Teddy was that I think between Teddy Shea in Knockadoon and somebody in Ardmore, they were trading periwinkles.
Yeah.
So, like, there was a lot of stuff going on outside of looking out for Hitler.
Oh, there was!
There was a lot of stuff going on as well, right?
You know, like, get your priorities right here. Like.
So they were trading periwinkles, right, back and forth. But the funny story about Teddy and May Sunday, Teddy said to your man, look, I'll be above in Kennedy's in May Sunday. Obviously, to give him a few bob.
Yes, yes.
And the lad in Ardmore, they said, how will I recognise you? How will I know you? Yeah. He said, I'll be the tallest man inside in the bar, he said.
No mistaking him. Looking at the entries here, actually, in the 6th of 44, sighted two destroyers. Two destroyers were sighted out over the coast. Yeah.
No, they would be Irish destroyers.
They'd be Irish destroyers. But as I say, everything was noted down the logbook.
But the whole reason I just felt that for those couple of hours, what was going on,
yes,
or what was about to happen, and like, I suppose everybody in Ireland was oblivious to what was actually going to happen, because the crowd in England didn't know what was going to go.
As I said, was shrouded in secrecy, because originating they were supposed to go on the 5th.
They were supposed
to go on the 5th, but the weather conditions stopped them, and it was one of the, I suppose you could say, one of the. I suppose, to be quite fair to the British, I suppose it was a story that was so well kept and so many people knew about it, that when they went in the 6th, and I think it was only last week we actually played a clip of one of the BBC people that were there, one of the reporters that were there, and he said, the eagle has landed, he says, look, we're here, he says, you know, D-Day has come. Like, then everybody knew about it, I suppose. You know,
I was very lucky back in about seven years ago now to actually go to Normandy.
I stood
in all those beaches, and I actually stood in Omaha Beach
and Gold and the whole lot.
I put my hand through the sand, and for that 5 minutes, the sense of, you know, it actually overwhelms you when you think back the thousands that were killed and slaughtered where I was standing.
And to look at Omaha Beach now.
If anybody has any interest in the Second World War, I'd highly recommend it to go there.
If you look at the beaches now, Omaha Beach, something at all like that, they look idyllic.
What a beautiful.
But when you see, and there's still the remains, I believe, of the bunkers. German concrete.
Yeah. The Atlantic Wall, yeah.
Yeah, there's still remains of that there.
Yeah,
know?
And they'll be there for the next 100 years because there'll be nothing moving, because they're nearly 4 or 5 feet thick of cement and reinforced.
Noel, just you're only in here about 6-7 minutes at this stage. just describe the book for the listeners at home, because I've tried to describe it and I can't.
Yeah, the book basically is, I suppose, it's a standard logbook that was brought up by the Marine and Coast Watching Service logbook. It was a standard issue, I suppose, a government issue, basically. And this was a government... this is actually... The watchtowers are set up, or the lookouts were set up, we'd say, by the government department. And what it was, basically, is, look, we had this thing of being invaded. We were going to be invaded. Now, as I said, we're just talking about Hitler there. Look, Donnybrook Strand in Dublin, I think there was a bombing. Mm. No, there was another one in Wexford. There was a lot of thing, you know. Now, at the time, Hitler was saying, or the Dönitz was saying, he was a Navy man. He was saying at the time that, oh, look, the pilots made a mistake. But what he wanted to do, what Hitler and Dönitz wanted to do, was to drag Ireland into the war, because they were looking, everybody was looking at the deep water berths. And naturally, we were, you know, the government had an incentive to have a lookout point. Like, no, in fairness, if Hitler decided to invade us, like, you know, we wouldn't stand a chance.
Oh.
But we were neutral, you know, and we stood by our neutrality, like, we were neutral. So the government set up these watchtowers, as you say, all over the place.
Yeah. And the book itself is in superb condition.
It's in superb condition. And, of course, like, at the time, you see, the logbook had to be kept... You know, the logbook was inspected every so often, and the logbook, every entry... The
logbook was godlike, the Bible.
The logbook was your Bible.
Yeah.
You know, and that had to be kept. So this particular one is in a remarkable condition, to the truth.
Yeah.
It's Knockadoon 21 Post, and it was a standard issue. And you wrote in just, you know, what you observed.
Yeah.
You know, the shifts,
They were 8-hour shifts.
8-hour shifts.
3 8-hour shifts. So from midnight to 8 in the morning, 8 in the morning till 4, and 4 to midnight.
So you had the same men
serving there then for the whole four or five years.
Mm.
The only time that there was slightly change is that if guys were going on leave, you might get guys from other LOPs coming to relieve them. But
it's a fascinating book.
It's a fat book. Another one entry now here, the 18th and 16th of 44, heard heavy gunfire 25 miles southeast of Post, reported to follow.
That's just a
remark.
Normally the visibility of the weather is down.
The weather would be here, we say. Yeah. Visibility moderate.
Yeah, I don't know what happened here, Mick. There's a lot of scribbling on it.
But when you think of it, there was, you know, this is the 18th to the 6th, 44.
Yeah, this is 18. This is, what, 6 and 2?
12
like.
Days. Kind
12
of
days after D-Day. Yeah.
12, D-Day plus 12, you could say.
Yeah, yeah. So you can imagine, you can imagine what went on. Yeah. But you made a point there, actually, that... A lot of these people that were involved in D-Day and that were involved, they didn't want to talk about it.
No.
You see, I know that on a personal note, my own father,
he
came home and he didn't want to talk about it. Now, he was working as a refrigeration engineer in the Blue Star and the White Star line, the Cunard line as such. Mm. But when the outbreak of war, of course, the British government took over all these. And they were bringing meat, beef and things from Buenos Aires to Britain. And there was an awful lot of refrigeration, you know, a lot of stuff. So he was appointed as a refrigeration engineer. And he was torpedoed 5 times during the war.
Hmm.
And he never spoke about it. When we were growing up at home, like, naturally, he brought home all his stuff. Yeah. And there was spanners and pliers and things with... White Star Line, Blue Star Line, stamped in them.
Mm.
We thought every house had these,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But wouldn't talk about it, never talked about it at all, because a lot of them, actually, and a lot of the servicemen, and indeed he was in the Merchant Navy, a lot of them suffered from shell shock.
Mm.
And he actually, when he came home, he actually suffered from shell shock.
No, I'm going to have to cut in there, sorry, because we're over time, number one. We've 2 ad breaks coming up, one after the other. We're
all right.
Noon and a half yet. Tom, I'm sorry I have to cut you.
No, there's no problem. Make sure you understood that.
But I've got
that,
a lot of calls in there. First of all, and most important thing of 2 calls was, is there any chance we could do a proper programme on this?
Oh yes. I've said this to you now.
Yes,
you know,
yeah, we
will
do.
Said it to Dara.
Yeah.
I think that it would be lovely to go out to the lookout post.
Yeah. And do a proper programme.
And give it a good hour.
It's just that, unfortunately, this morning is...
Oh, sure, I understand, and I knew this would happen, Mick.
Meg, here we're hanging there. Meg said that if people will go up to Collegiate Church last September, Norman MacDonald, David Kelly... and Billy Healy unveiled if you go in and right in front of you, all the names are down of the people from Yale that died in the First World War, and on the other side of the Second World War. Mm. And she said the dates, everything is down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful...
Where's the speech, sir?
In St. Mary's Collegiate Church here in the Isle, you know.
Actually, look, this is only a minute piece of...
We just touched the surface this morning with people's appetite for it. But I know.
But that is a very valuable piece
of... It's a subject that's very dear to my heart, and I'd love to do a programme on it.
I can well imagine, Noel. And I hope that you'll follow that up, because...
I will, of course.
It's definitely worth doing. And like, how long can you do it in Knockadoon? Could also go to Ardmore and do a session.
Exactly.
Because we touched on it actually in Ardmore when we were over there doing an outside broadcast in Ardmore. We touched on that actually.
Okay, well, listen, thanks for coming in.
No problem. And I appreciate the call. Hopefully, we'll have more time in the future. And once in a while, I must thank
the person that gave me the book. Yeah, yeah.
I spoke to him last night. He said, I can mention his name if you want. But having thought about it myself,
I won't.
That's absolutely
fabulous. I must thank him for it. And if anybody wants to take it off me, they're going to have to go through a lot of stuff to get it off me.
Oh, I'd be very careful.
I've only loaned of it.
Looking at that book, it's actually part of our heritage.
It is.
You know, but we like it. It's part of our heritage. It's very valuable, Mick,
and thanks for having me in.
Anytime, Tom.
I would encourage any local school, primary school, that have any stage they want me to talk about Knockadoon Lookout Post, or bring them, if they want to bring their children out there, I have no problem.
Well done,
John. Enough time.
Well done.
Because I think they're the people that we must be telling.
Exactly.
Of course. The 7, the 9, the 10 year olds.
Of course.
They're the people we've got to be telling about this.